Thank you, Jim. I didn't thought you never were going to turn me loose. I've been looking to see if you had a copy of Gone with the Wind. I thought maybe, we ought to read that. Last night you got to see Judy P. Now, if you missed it last night, you just ain't gonna see it. I'm an alcoholic, and my name's Franklin Williams. By the grace of God and fellowship with men and women like you, in this program, it hadn't been necessary for me to take a drink since October 15, 1956. The only reason Mary and these others have more sobriety than I do is because they quit drinking before I did. Now, they told me to keep this thing simple. Well, I'm real glad I sobered up while I'm still living. Now, I was born at a very young age. And evidently, I was born sober. I haven't heard anything to conflict with that. And I didn't have a bit of trouble with alcohol for 16 years. That's the first 16 years of my life. And then I had a slip. And it lasted 29 years. I didn't get much sleep last night. There's commotion going on over there. And I didn't know how to handle it, really. But somewhere around 2 or 3 o'clock this morning, I was awakened by two middle-aged blondes, about 16 or 18 years old. And they were screaming and beating on the door. And I couldn't get them to shut up. And I had to get up and let them gals out. Now that we got the spiritual side of the program out of the way, might as well get on to the brass tacks of this thing. The text of my sermon tonight will be to keep it simple and follow directions. I never have kept anything simple. I never have been able to follow directions. I can louse up a one-car funeral. But to let you know somewhat how I have learned somewhat and am learning, well, I'll have to bring in my sponsor. And I don't ever want to talk about anything about this program without mentioning sponsorship. Because I think if there's a weak link in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's in sponsorship. At least it is in the places that I'm familiar with. I think they used to have a school somewhere way back where they sent people and taught them how to be tough sponsors. Because they were all tough back then. They say you can run somebody off with that. Well, their opinion was, where are they going to go? They're already at the house at the end of the block. There ain't nowhere else to go. And they said, talk about God and you run them off. Well, how are they going to get sober? I'm not worried about those things. I can call my sponsor's name, David Gates, because he'd gone on to the big meeting. And David was the most uncouth man I ever knew. He just didn't know how to be couth. and he was nasty. He called me ugly names that I wouldn't repeat at a mixed gathering like this. But I think that you got to talk to the alcoholic at the level of his or her understanding. And David talked to me at the level of my understanding with profanity, my native tongue. And I don't believe that anybody else would have ever been able to get through to me if it hadn't been somebody like David. Now, this may sound a little corny or something to you, but I really believe that God selected my sponsor. I didn't have a thing in the world to do in getting David. In fact, I got a sponsor in a very peculiar way. Baron Hill, I don't know whether we got two people here from Memphis. I think he was dead when they came in. But Baron Hill was kind of the cyclops there then. And Press Battle, I can call his name. That's the one that my ex-wife turned me in. She turned me into the U outfit. And so Press got in touch with Baron. Baron's wife was an alcoholic. And they called David, so the three of them, so they sublet me right off the bat. We got over there and they didn't tell me what AA'd do for me. They told me things that it wouldn't do. And I thought, what in the devil am I tying up with something like this for if they ain't gonna do anything for me? So David was a spokesman. And I finally said, Mr. Gates, I said, how did I get, what is a sponsor? He says, don't have time to explain it to you tonight, it'll take too long. I said, well, how in the world did you get to be my sponsor? I ain't never been to a meeting. He said, we read about you in the paper. And it did, it had my picture in there. We read about you and none of us wanted you. So we drew straws and I lost. And said, I'm not going to enjoy this thing any more than you are. They took me to a meeting every night for a good while. And finally he said, you're going to have to get to the meeting the best way you can because you're getting dependent on me. And this is a program that you don't get dependent on somebody else but dependent on a God of your understanding. Now, I said, David, you know I don't have anywhere with to catch a streetcar or a taxi, or any way to get there. He looked at me with that little smirky grin on his face and said, we find that walking helps. So I went because nobody else would fool with me. And for the first number of meetings that we went to, David talked. And I said, David, don't anybody in this thing talk except you? He said, nobody you need to hear. I kept telling him, I was trying to break down what he is doing and find somebody to let me go at what the book refers to as the easier, softer way. And I said, oh, so-and-so, he says there ain't no must in this program. And I had to tell him that several times. And finally, he said, for your information and for his information, the word must is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous 74 times. But says there's one thing that's in there, a must not, that you need to know. Says, rarely have we seen a person stay sober who continues to drink. I said, that's real sharp, David. Where'd you get that? He said, you're not supposed to swallow any of that stuff. So you must not take it. All of them were married, and they had nice homes, they had nice wheels, they had nice threads. I said, David, if I had these things and had somebody to set me up in a little business, then I too could stay sober. And David, I didn't find out for 5 years that he could read. I read to him out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years, and he explained it to him. And a lot of it I had to explain a lot of times. He was slow to catch on, real slow. But the poor little fellow wanted to stay sober, and I thought with his intelligence that I had that I could be of some help to him. And I think I was, because he turned out to be a pretty good fellow after a few years of my counseling. And I know that God's got a special place for me for what I did for poor little old David. So he said, wife, he turned to page 97 in the big book over on the left-hand side, said, read that. It says, wife or no wife, job or no job, our sobriety does not depend on others, but in our willingness to trust God and to clean house. And then on the opposite page on 98, he said, read that. And then he turned to page 99 and said, read that. And then he said, what does it say? I said, David, it says the same thing. He said, I know it. Said, Bill knew that you'd liable to miss it on page one. So you was bound to see it on page 98, 99, 100. And he always referred to the big book as textbook. The textbook says, study that textbook, study that textbook. And he'd assign me lessons, assignments in there. And I'd have to explain those to him. And if I didn't explain them to his satisfaction, I had to do it again. So I'd read everything that David would tell me. And I'm grateful for that now, because now there's so much stuff floating around, I don't know where it comes from. It don't come from AA. It may come from BB, I don't know. But it ain't in the big book. And if you had somebody like David as your sponsor, and you hear this stuff, you know it don't come out of the big book. And that's the reason I'm grateful that David made me read these things to him and explain them to him. I said, David, ain't no way I can get a big book. You know that. I haven't got the money to eat on. I'm staying in a garage apartment as gratis of a friend. Just no way in the world. And he finally got tired of that, and he says, you so-and-so, you hadn't forgotten how to steal. And says, you go steal your big book. And says, we got a step in this program. When you get on to it, you make amends for stealing that book. Well, I didn't have to steal one. He finally gave me one. And he gave me some instructions. He said, take this textbook and read just the black part. And it took me a while to catch on to what he is talking about. Now, that's the type of sponsor I had. And they talk about all this love in AA. I didn't know where it was. I didn't see it. Of course, now I know what it was. It's tough love. And David loved me enough to tell me the truth. And he didn't pull any punches about it. Dr. Tebow said something about deflation of ego at depth. I don't think Dr. Tebow was the first one to think of that. I think David had something to do with that too. But he was a great little fella. And another thing I want to talk about some, lest I forget it, and I have some good friends in the audience that are members of Al-Anon. Incidentally, I didn't thank you for having me up here. I used to come twice a year for a good long while. And then they cut me down to once a year. And then I got busy carrying the message, as an old boy in California said, I was spreading the disease more than I was carrying the message. They had conflicts. And so this is several times they've had me up here to talk. Y'all were either sick as the devil or something. They asked me back up here. But in Al-Anon, I have a real tender spot for it. My wife Eloise, that a good many of you in the audience knew, she was an alcoholic, and she died with a little over 25 years of continuous sobriety. But maybe 15 years prior to that, I forget time, might have been further back than that. She switched over and joined Al-Anon. And some of you know the gal that caused her to do it, who was singing from Tuscaloosa. Very quietly, one day, singing says, "Eloise, you need to go to Al-Anon." Well, Eloise never did do anything on the spur of the moment. She had to think about it. And when she died, she was in her 14th year of a 7-day DOT deal. So she just didn't jump into something all of a sudden. But when she jumped into Al-Anon, she jumped in with both feet. And she was a terrific Al-Anon. She sponsored a lot of gals, and she went right by approved literature, didn't allow any other kind of literature in the meeting. She was a heck of a gal. Well, when we married, both of us being alcoholic, we fought like cats and dogs. Not physically, but verbally, in silent treatment. Lord, I'd pick a fight and jump up and leave, and I wouldn't see you anymore till late that night. And I don't see how in the world we survived. And Eloise had a little daughter, Mickey, and Mickey grew to hate me. And I'd say something to her, and she'd say, "You're not my daddy, and you don't have a thing in the world to do with me." Well, you know what I did? I reacted. And things just got worse and worse. And actually, the little old girl really did hate me. She hated to be around. And when she finished junior college, why, she jumped up and married the first thing that came along. And we know why, because she wanted to get away from us. And how that little girl came back is a miracle to me. Well, somewhere along there, Eloise, we had a big knockdown with Mickey. And Eloise knew then that she had to get into Al-Anon. And so she did. And gradually, one day at a time, our house was becoming a home. And with her applying the Al-Anon program to her life and me possibly doing something about my program, gradually we began to change. We got to where we enjoyed each other's company. We enjoyed going somewhere together. And when she'd come home from work, well, I'd have the coffee made, and we'd sit there for at least an hour and drink coffee and talk. So Al-Anon is real close to me. But lest you Al-Anons feel too smugly, you remember we drunks got you where you are today. And don't you forget it. Well, now Mickey lives 6 miles from me. And on Sundays, when I'm not out preaching like I am here, well, I go out there and have coffee. And many times in walking to the car, Mickey will put her arms around me and say, "Franklin, you're the only daddy I have, and I love you." I couldn't say that without crying. But knowing how bad things were, and then to see them as they are now, this is a great, great deal. And another thing, when I was staying at that garage apartment, didn't have anything to eat on, and a lot of days I didn't have anything but maybe a sandwich that Al-Anons would bring. We were having noon meetings, and the Al-Anons would come, and they'd bring sandwiches. And they got to where they'd put some in a sack and call me off to the side that when you go back to your place where you stay, you be there by yourself tonight, and you may not can go to sleep for a while, and you take this to snack on. Well, those gals knew that that's what I was living on. And we did this for a long, long time. So I have to be grateful to you, Al-Anon. Why did I come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? Maybe there's some other bogus person around that came for the same reason that I did. Not to get sober. I didn't come to stay in here 34 years and keep associating with bums like you. I came to get the monkey off of my back, and that's all. Well, the longer I stayed, well, the more I wanted to stay. And I finally got dug into this thing and got to applying the principles to my daily life. I decided there toward the last of my drinking that I was going to take my life. And I stole a piece of plastic hose and I borrowed a car. And I hooked up that hose to the exhaust and was going to fill the car with monoxide and kill myself. And a peculiar thing happened while I was getting all this arranged. I got thirsty. And I got thinking about that spider of wine. Now, I'd been on wine maybe 15 years. And I'm truthful in this, if I were to start drinking tonight, I'd be on wine within 24 hours. Because wine did something to me and for me that nothing else ever did. We talk about a spiritual awakening in this program. If you drank wine like I did, you'd stay in one of those things. Up here about this high off the ground, scratching and grinning. Of course, the reason that I got on wine was I had a hard time in the mornings getting a drink to stick. And if it was bourbon, why, it cost more to lose a drink of bourbon than it did wine. But after I found out what wine did, well, I didn't want anything else. So that's the reason that I came. And this thing don't work that way. I came waking people, and I wasn't going to get sober by waking people. I had to get onto the black part that's in those steps and get to work on it. I was in real bad shape because I couldn't read a paragraph and retain any of it. I'd break it down to sentence, and I'd read that and read that and read that and somewhat get a rest of it. But 30 minutes later, I couldn't tell you what it said. So I worked the program the best that I was capable of doing at that time. So I went for a period of 9 months drinking 6 days a week and trying to sober up on Monday morning so I could go to the Quonset group on Monday night. And that's work. Do social drinking for 6 days and sober up and go to a meeting. Now Bill says something about if you don't think this thing will work, try some controlled drinking. Well, let me tell you, you ain't gonna win and you ain't gonna like it. But that controlled drinking is an impossible deal if you're alcoholic. And I was alcoholic. So I went along for a period of 9 months, going to just enough meetings. I wasn't always able to go on Monday night. But as many as I could, I went to let the judge know. Incidentally, the judge sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this is a suggested program, and he suggested that I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I did, but try to get pressed, knowing that I was sober, get people that I was trying to con out of some money and so, and my ex-wife. So at the end of 6 months, I borrowed this car and this plastic hose and attempted suicide. And I got in there and there was just a little spot of wine left on that bottle. Now, Lord, what a shame to leave this world and leave that little drink behind. So I partook of it. And another thing happened, I passed out. Well, I waked up, and there's a difference between waking up and coming to. I waked up somewhere around 1 or 1:30 the morning, early morning of October 15, 1956. And I thought, I hate to leave this gal without leaving her a will. I wanted her to be able to say, old Franklin left me a will. So I had a yellow legal pad that David had given me to write my inventory on. And I wrote that will on there. And I don't know what all I put on there, a bunch of old mess. I'm going on. You have everything. I'd hocked it all. And I had two suits, a suit of khakis and a suit of underwear. And it had holes in it, and the holes matched. So I wrote that whole page of some old junk, I don't know what it was. Got on close to the end of the page, and I'd cried so much that tears had dropped down, and the thing was too moist, the pen wouldn't write. So I put an arrow up there and said, see next page. Oh, I had a deal. Now, I don't know about you when you drink, but I just love to cry when I drink. And I love to listen to music and cry. And this person had, I called it a graffinola in there. The thing had a horn coming out of it, and you'd wind it up. And she had Al Jolson's Sonny Boy. And Nobody Loves Me, and some of this old hillbilly music. And I'd put on a record and start playing and start writing on my will. And the thing would run down, and I'd have to jump up and crank it up again, and I'd just slow my singing down, my crying down to keep time with the music. And then as it picked up, my crying would pick up. And I cried so much I couldn't cry no more. And I got to thinking about my funeral and all the people that was going to be there. And I could see my wife standing up and looking down at the corpse and saying, you poor dear, if I had only understood. And she had two idiot brothers that made me an alcoholic. And one is on either side of her, and they said the same thing, honey, you killed old Franklin. You killed her. And she had two doctors, MDs, that one of them tried to send me to Keeley, over close to Chicago, and the other one was going to send me to Whitfield, in Insane Asylum in Mississippi. And that's when I ran away from home. Came to Memphis dodging a lunacy warrant. And so these two doctors, they said, honey, if you'd have turned Franklin in to us, he'd still be living. Says, you killed him. And says, we hope that the guilt and the remorse won't be too heavy for you to have to carry for the balance of your life. And I just cry some more. And I cried myself to sleep. And then when I waked up at this time, around 1 or 1:30, I felt differently from I had ever felt. And I fell to my knees. And for the first time in my adult life, I said a honest and sincere prayer. And I said the most important prayer that an alcoholic can say, or that any person who is sincere I asked God to help me. And had I not said anything else, that would have been sufficient, because I was in earnest about this thing. And I thought about those steps, and even though I'd been around you for 9 months, with a closed mind, I remembered some things that you had told me and some things that I had read to David out of the textbook. And I became convinced of the first two steps. I became convinced that there wasn't any way in the world that I could determine how much I was going to drink. I couldn't tell you when I was going to quit, and I couldn't keep from drinking, and my life was unmanageable. Now, an unmanageable life to me is just this simple. I did the things I didn't intend to do, and I left undone the things I did intend to do. And an unmanageable life is just that simple to me. So I became convinced of these first two steps, and I took the third step. And I think if you're ready, it don't take long to do it. And I was ready. Now, I'll later tell you how I didn't take the third step correctly, but I'll get into that in the next 2 or 3 hours. So, early the next morning, about 6 to 6:30, I waked up, went to this person's back door and asked if I might call David. And I did, and David came right on over there. He sat down on the end of that brass bed and told me many things about David. Now, I know that he had told me some of these things before, and maybe more than that, but I didn't remember. And he looked at me and said two words, I think, which saved my life. He said, "I understand." No one had ever told me they understood. But I knew from the look in David's face, the countenance of his face, that he did understand. And he said, "They're going to get some of your time." Now, he wasn't talking about Al-Anon. He was talking about the men in blue down at the local Bastille. And says, "I'm going to give you some directions." He said, "Every chance you get on your knees." David said, "Real alcoholics get on their knees." And said, "I can't call you an alcoholic, but I can call you a real alcoholic." And said, "Real alcoholics get on their knees. And you get on your knees and pray for help that day. And if you stay sober, well, you get on your knees and you thank God at night. But all along during the day, you need to get on your knees and ask God for help." Says, "They're going to get some of your time." And says, "You're going to have to begin this deal of praying." I said, "David, you know I don't believe in prayer. I told you I was an agnostic." He said, "That don't make a darn. You just got to make up your mind whether you want to be a sober agnostic or a drunk agnostic." And I said, "This prayer business, I just don't believe in it." He said, "Nowhere in any AA literature does it tell you that you have to come here believing. Most of us come here not believing, but these steps, by supplying them to our lives, we come to believe. We come to believe by action. Things happen which I used to call a coincidence, but I had to start out using the group as my higher power, and I knew that this didn't come from the group. And it must come from a God of my understanding." And that was the only understanding I had. But he said, "Let me tell you something, dummy." Said, "The two most important things about prayer," says, "first is start doing it, And secondly, keep on doing it. And if you will do these, you will come to believe. And I challenge anybody, whether it be agnostic, atheist, members of AA, non-alcoholics, or what, if they follow these directions of starting to pray and continuing to pray, they will come to believe. I really believe it. It happened with me, and it's happened with many, many other people. And I didn't believe until I started this. So they did. In 2 days' time, the fuzz picked me up, and they took me into jail. And I stayed there 30 days before they tried me. And he told me, David told me, said, they're going to get some of your time. And sure enough, they did. They sent me to the penal farm. And out there, I knew I had to have this program. And on Saturdays, we could see the warden. So that Saturday, I went in and talked to him, and he knew David. And I told him that I'd like for us to start an AA group out there with his permission. He said, we'd like for you to. We'd like to have one. He said, I know something about AA behind the walls. I've learned it from other places. And the one that he started talking about was, oh, what is the warden out in California? So anyway, that's the first one that he knew anything about, and it's the first one that we ever had behind the walls. So David and two other people came, and we started a group there on that Saturday. David was on my visitors list, but they'd let David come out and go to the meeting with us on Saturday, and then he'd come back on Sunday, and I could visit with him. And that's when he'd give me assignments while he was there on Saturday, and then he'd give me a test on Sunday when he was out. And then if I'd finish theirs, he gave me some more. So he forced that big book. I stayed out there my required time. I didn't get out a day earlier than I was supposed to. I got out when I was supposed to. I didn't have a job and couldn't be bonded and had a real hard time even making it. And I'm glad that it worked out the way it did, because if I could have stepped right into a good job, that ego would have returned and I'd have been drunk and side of a week, I imagine. But I really had to scratch for a good long while. Finally, I'd get a little better job and a little better job. I got real active in my group. And incidentally, I belonged to the Olive Branch group at Olive Branch, Mississippi. I did belong to the Quonset group in Memphis, but for reasons I won't have time to explain, the Quonset group disbanded. So I'm a member of the Olive Branch group, and I think it's the best group in the world. And Eloise used to say, if you don't think that your group is the best group in the world, don't go somewhere else and louse up that group. Stay where you are and get active in it and make your group the best group in the world. So for 9 months, approximately 9 months, I came in January, and by the middle of October, I had my last drink. But I'd go get drunks off the bar stool and take them home with me. They was going to get sober on the mod tutelage. And I had one heck of a time. And I had to quit taking them because they began to steal stuff out the house and get drunk and raise Cain around. But I was really a 12-stepper. And I called myself the president of AA. Nobody elected me, but David said that I elected myself. And people I live in a small town, and everybody out there knew I was an AA because I'd talked in the church. And they'd flag me down on the road, and they'd say, we understand you're the president of AA. I said, yeah, that's right. That's right. I've been president a long time. What can we do for you? Well, I'd go to see them. And you know, there's some of those people that are sober in spite of in spite of me. So I went along for a period of around 9 months, going to AA real regular, trying to work the steps and explaining the steps to David. And I was getting full of self-pity and full of resentments. David made me come to the meeting an hour early and to stay at least an hour after the meeting. And I think with me, the meetings before the meetings and the meetings after the meetings are the best meetings I ever went to. David came out, was there that night when I got there. I went a little earlier than the hour. And David must have gotten some kind of inkling that something was going to happen. So he was there, and I said, David, I've got to talk to you. He said, I know it. I've been trying to approach you for several weeks, but you had a wall that I couldn't get through. And says, I've been praying to God that you'd either come to me or somebody else and get it out in the open before you got drunk. And God has answered my prayer. So we sat down over there in the counter, in the corner, and David told me a lot of things about himself. And I told David some things I had never told another human being. And that's, you don't do something, and you live long enough, you're going to wind up back out to the penal farm. And I didn't want to go, and I didn't want to drink. And I said, what can I do, David? He said, there's nothing to do, but you're just a new person to Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't know anything, and what you do know, you don't practice. Said, we're going to start with the doctor's opinion. And says, you go home, and every waking hour, don't you go to another meeting for a week. Every waking hour, you get your textbook and start with the doctor's opinion and read and read and study and restudy, so on that. Then you get into the first four chapters and you do the same thing there. You read and read and study and restudy. He said, do you know why I want you to do this? I said, no, I don't. So he said, turn back to chapter 5, to the ABCs, and read me those ABCs. And I read them to him. And he says, do you know what they mean? I said, no, I don't. He said, those first three steps are contained in the doctor's opinion and the first four chapters. And says, there's no way that you take the first two steps. You become convinced of it. And I guarantee you that there's no AA literature that explains how to take the first two steps. You don't take them. You become convinced of them. So it says in the book, being convinced, now we are ready for step three. So step two is in the ABCs, step one and two. And step three, don't take long to take it. So after I had answered all of David's questions about those first three steps, he said, let's go out on the lake Saturday. He believed in going out to the lake. We went out there and he had me to read what to do in the third step. And you know, after being around you for 9 to 9.5 years, I didn't know that Bill suggested that we take the third step with another human being. Neither had I seen the third step prayer in there. Because, see, I had a block against those things. Chuck used to say, we see when we see and we hear when we hear. And that is sure true, because I heard things in those times in AA that when I finally did hear it, I couldn't remember of having heard it. But when we, this has sure been true with me. We see when we see and we hear when we hear. So David had me to read the third step prayer. And then he said, let's kneel down here by this log, and said, I'd like to hear you say it in your own words, and I think God would too. So we did. And this is about what I said, and it's about what I say every day, many times a day, most times. God, I offer myself to thee to do and build with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them may bear witness to those that I might help of thy love, thy service, and thy way of life. May I always do thy will. David said, we are all right now. And said, it's going to be necessary for you many times a day to ask God to relieve you of the bondage of self. And I think that's about as important a prayer as I offer every day now. Because self is my problem. Selfishness and self-centeredness, Bill says, is the root of our problem. And it was with me. So he said, we are ready for step four now, and I want you to read. There again, see, he didn't tell me he had me to read. Read what to do. And it starts off there with the God-given instincts. I'll get to that just a little bit later. The things that I need to examine in my life is resentments, fear, and sex. And he said, turn to page 65 over on the right-hand side, where it explains how to do resentments. And it has resentments listed there, and then what caused that resentment, and what is the effect of it. See, I hear people say, and I was told, and I tried to write an inventory first the way that these people said, because the easier, softer way. But I firmly believe, and David told me this, that writing a life history for an inventory is worse than taking no inventory at all. Why do I say this? Because I experienced it. What I did, I brought things into light that had happened a long, long time ago. And, and it made for more guilt and more remorse. And I had more problems after I did that than before. And Bill says that the purpose of an inventory is to find out what caused these things and what is the result. In writing a life history, I certainly would have never found out what caused it and what was the end result. And Bill says this is a design for living. And I wouldn't have found a design for living by writing a life history. So David said, you list your resentments. And says you write at the top of the page, resentments. Then on the next two pages, on one of them you put sex, the other one you put fears. In fact, fears is the second deal. So he said, write all your resentments down. List all of them. And says it's going to take more than one page for you, because I've heard you get a lot of these resentments out. And when you'd get drunk, you'd always come out with a lot of your resentments. So he said, read that first resentment. I resent Mr. Brown. Why? Because his attentions to my wife. What effect does it have on me? It affects my security and it affects my sex. And what is the end result? a little four-letter word in parentheses, fear. I found out fear was the end result of all of mine. So I listed all those resentments and carried them on out. What caused them, what was the effect, and what was the end result. Then I listed the people I had harmed. And the reason I did that is because David showed me over in step 8 that you made a list of the people that you harmed in step 4. So I put those down. What caused the problem and what was the effect? Then I listed my character defects. Now this was a real eye-opener to me. It says character defects, it's on page 51 in the old 12 and 12. I don't know what page is on a new one because I don't have one. But it says character defects representing instincts gone astray. Representing instincts gone astray. Being the primary cause of my drinking and failure at life. Now let me get back to instincts because I hadn't mentioned them. David said he didn't know whether Bill knew this when he wrote the big book or whether he didn't have room for it, but he had an idea that he didn't know it. He found it out during those years between the time he wrote the big book and he wrote the 12 and 12. But David had me to turn to the first paragraph in step 4 on the 12 and 12 and to read what the three God-given instincts are. There's an instinct for sex, there's an instinct for material and personal stability, and there's an instinct for companionship. And I found out that those three God-given instincts are the greatest tool that I found to find out what's wrong with me. All right, going back to that resentment deal. I resent Mr. Brown. Why? Because his attention to my wife. What is the effect? Every one of those was going to affect one or more of the God-given instincts. It affected my sex. It affected my emotional security, and it affected my companionship, and so on down the line. I don't think there's a single one of them that didn't affect at least three of the God-given instincts. So character defects representing instincts gone astray being the primary cause of my drinking and failure at life. And unless I become willing to work hard toward the elimination of the worst of these, both serenity and peace of mind will elude me. So I even listed the 7 cardinal sins. Now it don't tell me in the big book or the 12 and 12 to list those there. But Bill listed them, so I thought if it's good enough for Bill, it's good enough for me. I didn't want to drink no more, and I'd do anything that David told me to do back then. So I even listed those. So then it took me a good while to get my inventory written, but God counseled with David at certain points along there. And he'd look at what I had written, and he'd suggest things that I do. So I took as full and complete an inventory as I was capable of taking at the time. Now I hear some people say you can work the first 9 steps and then throw it away. I don't know where they get that. The book don't say that. Now about the inventory on page 51 of the 12 and 12, the old one, it says the taking of a 4-step inventory is but the beginning of a lifetime process. And I've taken many inventories since that time. And one of the reasons, or as good a reason as I know, for having a sponsor, I still have a sponsor. And I have a sponsor that'll tell me the truth. And my sponsor can detect change in me before I recognize it. And I need a sponsor like that that'll tell me. And he'll say, "Don't you think it's about time that we took another inventory?" And I know what he's talking about, and I do it. So then David had me to sit down on that log after after I finally got my inventory of what I thought was complete. Well, we went back out on the lake and stayed all day. It took that long to go over my inventory. I hear people say they took inventory during a lunch break. I don't know what kind of inventory they had, but it wasn't a full one, I can guarantee you. It took us all day. And David did something which I'll forever be grateful for. David took part of his with me. I don't know what part or how much of it, but he took that which would correspond or be similar to what I had. And I thought I was the only nut in the world until David did this. I saw that there was somebody else that was just as fruity as I was. So after we took that, he had me to sit down on that log and to read and then read aloud what to do. It says, "Go home and find a quiet place and thank God that you know him better." Not that you know him, but that you know him better. Thank God that you know him better. And examine the first five proposals, the first five steps. And if you've left out anything, go back and do it. If not, well, then you are ready to go to step six. On page 76 in the big book, it has four steps explained in a very short order. And it don't take long, really. It don't take long. So, first had to do with my character defects, getting rid of them. Now this may be controversial. I don't think that my character defects have been removed. I know that God can do anything that we ask him to do. But I think that what God expects me to do, the things that I can do. So I think what has happened and is happening with me, instead of the thing being removed, they've been replaced. For instance, if I have gratitude, there's no way I can have self-pity. So I've been able to practice the opposite of what that character defect is. Now maybe you construe that as God removed it, maybe so, but I think there's something I have to do. So I did that, and then I got with David, and he showed me that the main thing that I had to do in that step was to pray for willingness. I think willingness, in fact, the book tells me, is a key to the whole deal. And I had to pray for more willingness. Then there's a prayer at the end of step seven, which I hadn't seen. And that prayer being, this is about the words that it's in: "God, I am now willing that you take all of me, the good and the bad. Remove every single defect of character which stands in my way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. May I always do thy bidding." David said, "We all right up to now. Now we're ready for the making amends." And I listed the people that I'd harmed, I told you in step four. And we took each one of those. And there was one wrong that I had sworn I'd never make because I hated that man. And he had wronged me, but I had wronged him first. Well, I forgot about that. And I told David, I said, "There's no way I'm going to make amends to old so-and-so." He said, "Before I agreed to go along with you after that 9.5 years, I made you promise me that you'd do anything and everything that I ask you to do. Now you've got a choice. You either do it or you get drunk. Now, David, I don't want to get drunk. He said, I know you don't. But he knew this man very well, and he was about 75 miles from where I lived. David said, I'll have my car here when the club opens in the morning at 7 o'clock. It'll be full of gas. And you go down there and see that fella and make amends. So I did. And I didn't know this for years later. But I thought it was odd that this fellow was at a certain place at that time of morning. And what had happened, David had called him and told him that I'd be down there and what the purpose was. Well, when I pulled up to this place, that man was sitting in his automobile with the radio on. He got out and he got over to my car almost before I could get out. And tears were running down his cheeks. And tears were running down my cheeks. And as far as my sobriety is concerned, I don't think I'd have had to say anything because of our actions. But I made amends to that man. And we became very, very, very close friends. And David kept me from getting drunk over that deal, I know. Continue to take personal inventory. There again, it says that one inventory is not the only one. I really think the way I understand this program that continued to take personal, continued is the important word there. I think it's meant to do on a daily basis. Sometimes I do it on a daily basis, but sometimes I don't. And I hurt. And I'll hurt until I can't stand that hurt anymore. I think we all have a different tolerance of pain. I can take a lot of pain. But pain has motivated me to do everything that I've done for my betterment in this program. So I made amends. Now it bothered me that I couldn't make amends to my father because he'd been dead a number of years. But I was told that the mere fact that I was willing to make them, if he were available. So I don't have any guilt along that line. That gets me down. Sought through prayer and medication. down at Corinth, Mississippi, on the wall, they got great big old sign thing there with the steps on it. And he gets down to that and it says, with prayer and medication. And they had a bunch of new people to come in and they wanted to change it, and they did change it. And a few old timers that left, they went in there one day when the meeting wasn't going old, and they took down that new one and put the old one back up there. The only place I know of where it says prayer and medication. Meditation is important to me, really more so than prayer. I pray for things sometimes, and I guess it's all right if I'm willing to accept maybe or no or wait or whatever. But I guess it's all right to go through the motions, stay in practice of doing it. But meditation, I've learned to do a pretty good job at this. And I had a real hard time. And I went to David and I said, David, I'm having trouble with meditation. He said, what? I said, well, I'll start out and I'll jump way off over here and I don't seem to stay on track. He says, why don't you read your AA literature? And I said, what? He said, he always had the big book and a 12 and 12 in his car. And he says, let's look in there. So I looked in there on step 10. And Bill says, now what about meditation? Now it seems that other people had trouble with this besides me. And Bill says to take a prayer that you think is an outstanding prayer, analyze that prayer, and then try to place to see where that fellow is as opposed to where you are. And the prayer that he suggested was the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi, most beautiful prayer I ever heard. And I'd read a sentence of that and meditate on it. And I continued to do this. I finally got to where I could stick to that. Now, I don't do the same thing every morning. I have six words that I say every day, and they're meaningful to me. And I think I can sum up the whole program of Alcoholics Anonymous with those six words. Trust God, clean house, and help others. And I say this every morning in my meditation. And I don't just repeat it. I meditate on it. Sometimes I've got some physical problems, and I had to spend a lot of time in a recliner. At least I spend a lot of time in a recliner. And I've got recorders there, I got tapes there, I got the big book there, the 12 and 12. And maybe I'll get thinking about old Jim, and I'll pull a tape there of Jim, and I'll get to listening, and I'm meditating over it. And I'm awed at the power that's in this program, the power that's in this program. I used to say it scared me, but it really don't scare me. I'm just awed at it. And I come to believe and to realize that this thing is a tremendous deal, and I'm only scratching the surface of it. There's no limit really to where I can go in this program if I'll do the things that the big book suggests that I do. So sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. Then, having had a spiritual awakening. Now, this word scared the stew out of me. And David finally had me to turn to Appendix 2 in the back of the book and to read in the first paragraph what spiritual awakening is. And it says it's purely and simply a personality change sufficient to relieve my alcoholism. That's real simple. See, I had it confused with what I had programmed myself or the church or somebody had programmed me. But it's real simple. And then he said, long as you're in this and you're always asking me about it, and I didn't give you much of an answer, read in the last paragraph of it. And it says that many of our members suspect that a power greater than themselves is doing for them what they could not do for themselves. In effect, or in essence, this is a spiritual awakening. I said, doggone, David, that's simple. Why didn't you tell me this a long time ago? He says, I've thought about it and prayed about it a lot of times, but you're too darn hard-headed. You always want to argue. And you wasn't simple enough. I knew you had to suffer a little bit more to get a little bit more simple and get a little bit more uncomfortable with being with being uncomfortable. And said, the time's right now. Well, I knew that something had entered my life and something had entered David's life that had completely changed us. And I could accept this as a spiritual awakening. I've been around you people long enough to see and experience the tremendous healing power of love. Tremendous. The people in the Quonset group in Memphis, Tennessee love this old drunk soul. That's the only way I can explain it. I know David had me to look up in the dictionary. He took a dictionary with him too. He had me to look up in there about believing and to get a definition of to believe. And one of the definitions is to rely. And I am coming to rely on the forgiveness of God for yesterday and the grace of God for tomorrow. And that only leaves today. And there's nothing that can come up in my life today that can't be handled if I turn it over to God. How do I know this? Because David had me to read where it said that the problem ahead is never greater than the power behind. Now, I have another way of putting this. There's no limit to where I can go in this program because I'll never run out of God. And that is a comforting thought to me. I'll never run out of God. I will never completely get rid of my character defects for one reason and one reason only, because ego returns. The only thing that causes problems between me and you and me and the God of my understanding is ego. I'll never completely get rid of ego because I'll never completely get honest, 100% honest. And when I refer to honesty in this program, I'm not talking about cash register honesty. I'm talking about void of self-deception. I was a past master at deceiving myself, and I still am. So if I could get 100% honest, I'd be as big as God. So there ain't no way to do that. But I can make progress toward that. An old boy at Little Rock, Arkansas, always says this, and I wish I'd said it, but I didn't. And I got to give Joe McQueenie credit for it. He said the greatest carrier of a message was a cat named Paul Revere. And Paul Revere rode through the countryside yelling, "The British are coming, the British are coming." Not one time did he stop that horse and get on and say, "Now, if I were you, I'd do this about your marital problem. I'd do this about your financial problem," and so on. No, he carried a simple message. Now, they could have sent Benjamin Franklin, but he was a philosopher. And he'd have still been there. And we'd be British subjects now. They sent the right man. And now, Joe didn't say this, I said this. The message took care of itself. Now, when he told them British is coming, them cats knew to haul ass. And so it is with my program. Well, not my program. My program got me drunk, the AA program. The AA program, we have a message to carry. And what is that message? If I read the black part of step 12, well, it says a spiritual awakening as the result of the first 11 steps. Now, that's the only message I have to carry, because that's what, if I read the 12th step, that's what it says. So if I deliver that message, the message will take care of itself. I close, as I always close, with my football story. It's not much of a story, but I just like the way I tell it. And I like to hear it, and I hadn't heard it tonight. And I like to think that God is saying unto me, "Franklin, I'm getting up a football team, and I'm going to make you the quarterback, and I'm going to give you three men in the backfield that you lost during your active alcoholism. And I'm going to give them back to you in the reverse order in which you lost them. I'm going to give you hope, faith, and charity. And in the line, I'll give you seven men that you were introduced to in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The two ends, honesty and patience. That tackles, I've forgotten my tackles, at God's unselfishness and gratitude, and its center willingness. Now, it'll be necessary that you use willingness on every play. And this game's going to last a lifetime. There'll be no timeouts. So I'm going to have to give you some ground rules. And these are the 12 commandments, the 10 commandments. And the first four of these have to do with your relationship with your manager and your coach, God. And the last six have to do with your relationship with your teammates. Now, the ball is... This is going to last a lifetime. The game's going to last a lifetime. And I'm the sole official. And any decisions I make shall be final. Now, the ball is your eternal soul and the goalpost of the gates of heaven. Now, get in there and play ball. I need each and every one of you in my search for truth in this game of life. And if you don't believe that this program will work, just keep it simple and follow directions. And if you don't believe that God will help you, just ask Him. Thank you, and God bless you, and I love you.